This is Henri Ford, the Dean and Chief Academic Officer of the Miller School of Medicine at the University of Miami, and welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming to our podcast an amazing individual who is sure to delight you. And this is Dr. Ranjit Ramasamy, who is the Director of Reproductive Urology at the Desai City Urology Institute and an internationally recognized star in the field of urology. Dr. Ramasamy studied the first andrology fellowship program in the Southeast United States right here at University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He has authored nearly 500 peer-reviewed manuscripts, and he has received numerous prestigious awards for his spectacular accomplishments in research in the field, including most recently the American Urological Association's Golden Cystoscope Award, which is the highest honor that anyone can receive in the field. Dr. Ramasamy, it is such a privilege to welcome such a brilliant faculty member to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dean Ford. I'm very happy to be here and really happy to share some of my experiences and thoughts and some of our research that we've been doing here at the Miller School of Medicine.
That's absolutely amazing. But first, tell us, what do you do with a Golden Cystoscope?
So the Gold Cystoscope Award is given by the American Urology Association every year to an individual that's accomplished the most within 10 years of their training.
Wow.
And so this year, the award was given for both clinical research as well as mentorship. To me, as we all know, Dr. Parekh, our chair and the director and founder of the Desai City Urology Institute, won it 10 years ago. So it's really an honor for me to win it this year, and to have two Gold Cystoscope Awards within the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, I think is a fantastic achievement.
We're going to have to build a little shrine.
Yes.
You know, here lives the Golden Cystoscope.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's phenomenal and clearly well-deserved, given the fact that after 8 years, you already have over 450-plus publications. But we're going to get to that.
Yes.
But tell our audience a little bit about your journey. How you get to... From where you grew up,
right,
to the point where you are the winner of the Golden Cystoscope.
Got it. So I actually grew up in India, and
where in
it's Chennai. It's
north south
south India,
okay.
South India.
Mm-hmm.
And our family traveled around a bit in Malaysia, a bit in New Zealand, and so I was exposed to multiple cultures. And then our family moved when I finished high school. I started college here in Rutgers in New Jersey. Given my multicultural upbringing, it was very nice to come to a place like New Jersey, where it was almost another home to me. About 10% of the population at Rutgers are actually Indian, and so it was fantastic for me to get immersed in a multicultural society like New Jersey. And thankfully, I did well, and they gave me a nice scholarship to stay on for medical school at Rutgers, so I stayed on there. And then did my residency at Cornell in Manhattan in New York. And that sort of catapulted my career to think about men's health, andrology. That's where my interest started, and then went on to do a fellowship at Baylor in Houston, Texas.
But let me just tell us a little bit. Why urology? What got you interested in urology when you were in med school?
When I was in med school, when I was a first-year med student, we got assigned to a faculty mentor. And one of my faculty mentors that we got assigned to was a pediatric urologist. We go to free lunches to just about every specialty that they invite us to, because as a med student, as a first-year med student, you don't have a lot of money. And so you just go to every free lunch that they give you. It just so happens that this pediatric urologist asked me a question about hernias. You as a pediatric surgeon must know this very well. What is the difference between a direct and an indirect inguinal hernia? And I had studied that morning, and I answered the question, and he brought me over at the end of the lunch, and he said, are you interested in urology? I was like, what's urology? He's like, come to the OR tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock at this time, I'll see you there. He probably thought I was never going to show up, but me being me, I was like, oh, if somebody tells me to do something on my first year med student, I was like, yeah, let's show up. So I showed up at 7 o'clock, and absolutely fell in love with everything that he did, and worked with him doing research in pediatric urology during my med school, and got instantly turned on. So I think a lot of us in our careers, we make decisions based on people we meet, people we fall in love with. So I sort of fell in love more with him and what he did and less of like actual urology itself. And so I think I sort of looked up to people within the field, within urology, absolutely loved every interaction that I had with urologists and the people that were there in the field. But that's what drew me to the field.
Fantastic. Yeah, and then we'll get back to that because you're speaking to the power of mentorship,
right?
Something that you have become
right.
quite good at yourself. Right. So urology, and then you decided to do a fellowship in male reproductive medicine.
Yes.
Yeah, tell me about that and what triggered that interest.
So within urology, I was absolutely interested in aspects of men's quality of life. A lot of urology is focused on urologic oncology in treating men with cancers, urologic cancers like prostate cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, testicular cancer. But I saw patients during residency who got treated very well with cancer, but there was nobody to look after them. They had issues such as urinary incontinence, erectile dysfunction, testosterone deficiency, infertility sometimes because some of these treatments with chemotherapy and surgery rendered them infertile. But this patient population was almost not served at all, and nobody was paying attention to them because the doctors and urologists were happy that they cured their cancer. But the patients were happy that their cancer got cured, but they were unhappy because nobody was there to like take care of all of the problems and survivorship after cancer. And so that's what actually drew me to men's health, male reproductive urology, and that's what drew me to a fellowship at Baylor to focus on men's health and reproduction.
Outstanding. And what attracted you to the Miller School?
So when I finished my fellowship at Baylor, I actually had several options. I interviewed all over the country, and my wife wanted to stay somewhere warm. We had moved to Houston. We had left New York, New Jersey, and she said, I don't think we're going to go back up north. So despite getting a lot of offers up north, I had the choice to go to either UCLA or to come here to the University of Miami. And Dr. Diffin Park, the chair, is what drew me here. I think one of the best advices that I got in training was to follow the chair. If you want academic success, you got to follow the chair. It's not the program, it's not the setup, it's the chair support, and that's going to be the cornerstone for your success. And that's why I came here to the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine.
Great, and it's just been remarkable. You studied the first andrology program in Southern
Southeast United States.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, and what led you to. To start that.
Yep. So when I interviewed for jobs, I realized that there were a lot more job opportunities than there were even people that were in training. And the training that I received, I was blessed to train it to stellar places like Cornell and Baylor. But I felt that some of the training that was happening at several other programs in the country was either not up to par for people to get trained for a job in andrology. And so I thought maybe we should start a training program here. Because there were a lot of people in Florida who wanted to stay within the state. A lot of people within the Southeast United States that wanted to not go far, live away from their families for a year. And so I said, this is a huge need within urology that we actually need to train the next generation of urologists who specialize in reproductive urology. And so I approached Dr. Parekh and Dr. Lin, who used to be here as faculty, was kind enough to provide the support and the resources. And we were able to start the first program. It's now in its seventh year, and we've trained over 10 fellows in reproductive urology.
And what kind of an impact do you think?
I think it's a fantastic impact. I think 8 of them have actually gone on to take academic jobs within the United States. They have started their own programs in andrology, in reproductive urology. Like we discussed, most urology programs are very well equipped with urologic cancers, with people taking care of kidney stones, people taking care of bladder dysfunction. But somehow cancer survivorship and men's health is often forgotten in the department. And so now that we actually have people who are well-trained, who are equipped to take care of that patient population, I hope we're making a significant impact, not just here, but with training the next generation.
True. I'm sure that is a problem, especially in this region and in...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And everywhere. And I think the number of urologists that are in need is huge. The gap, we just don't have as many urologists that are graduating for the aging population within the United States. And so the more I think we're able to train and more equip these urologists to go help this patient population, I think the better we're serving the society.
And then we've certainly seen the demographic shifts in South Florida.
Absolutely.
So great. So talking about impact, let's shift a little bit to focus on your area of research interest, which right. is fertility.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the problem with male fertility right there. Is there a problem?
Yeah.
And what is the incidence and what are the underlying reasons that we're seeing an increase, if any?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think the biggest part that's forgotten in a couple with fertility is unfortunately the women always get blamed for any fertility problems that arise within a couple. And the females get worked up, pretty invasive workups with lots of blood tests, lots of ultrasounds, lots of dye tests before even thinking about it could be a male factor.
Is this just a cultural problem?
I think it's a cultural problem. I don't think this is, I think this problem exists all over the world. And so I don't think this is just social stigma that has been in society for several years that we've just followed along and sort of kept up with it. Unfortunately, because simple sperm analysis in a male will reveal lots of problems that the male partner could have. And unfortunately, because of social stigmas, the female gets all of the blame. But I think finally, society is now waking up to thinking that maybe 50% of the equation in a fertility problem is the man.
And it does stick to the table.
Yes, exactly. And so I think men are sort of thinking, maybe it is my problem. And so they're waking up to getting tested. I think lots of problems in society that we have now seen with sperm counts just declining over the last few years. Within the last decade, we've seen sperm counts declining. Within the last 20 years, we've seen testosterone levels declining. And I think there's lots of
problems. What is that?
I think as a society, we've just become less physically active. Obesity rates have gone up. Diabetes has gone up. And sedentary lifestyles have gone up. Our exposure to drugs like testosterone, steroids, marijuana, smoking have all increased over the last 10 to 20 years.
And they all have an adverse impact
on sperm. And I tell people all the time, whatever is bad for your heart, which I think all of them are, that we talked about, is also bad for your sperm. And so if you gain weight, if you become obese, if you lead an unhealthy lifestyle, it's going to affect your fertility. And we are seeing that in society. And so I think the prevalence of male fertility as a problem has only increased in the last few years.
So just about anybody can be at risk.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So how do you begin to make the diagnosis of male infertility?
So we start with a simple sperm analysis, and then there are different parameters within sperm analyses. We look at what the concentration of the sperm is. We look at how fast the sperm are moving, and we look at the shape of the sperm. And if there are any problems, any of these things, then we investigate further to see if there are any correctable causes of male fertility, like a varicocele or hormonal issue, or simple things like people have been using drugs and steroids and smoking and cannabis and vaping and nicotine, that we try and simply stop and try and reverse some of these factors.
And okay, you've made a discovery that there is an abnormality. So how do you begin to treat that? How do you correct that?
So can you? Yeah, no, you can actually, because there are simple things that we could do, like lifestyle modifications.
Okay.
We've recommended things all the way from weight loss to stop smoking. And stop smoking cannabis. People don't associate cannabis and pot with smoking anymore, and they think these are two separate things, and one is very healthy and one is not. And I think there is misconceptions in society that one is healthy, and I think we're trying to do research to actually show that it is actually not. And then we could do simple things like surgical correction, like if there's a large varicocele, to try and fix it,
okay,
and to give medications that can try and improve your sperm count and quality.
So why does this varicocele, which is it's a cluster of
Right.
Looking like veins. Why does that cause infertility?
So so the testes are outside the body. And so body temperature is 37 degrees. Testicular temperature is 34 degrees. So it's 3 degrees cooler. God designed it that way for the sperm to survive in cooler temperatures. And so varicocele with veins around the testis can increase the temperature of the testis because the blood pools around the testis. And anytime you increase the temperature around the testis, it can affect the sperm concentration and motility. And with global warming and climate change happening, I think we're going to see an adverse impact on sperm counts, in the next few years to come. Wow.
So another important treatment, another important reason why we need to address climate change. Okay,
exactly.
Great.
Because we may not have evolution if we continue on this path.
Profound. Yeah. Something that I actually never stopped to reflect on.
Right.
But that is a real impetus to correct that problem. Let me shift to yet another population that is severely impacted by infertility. Mm-hmm. This is, and that's individuals with spinal cord injury.
Right.
I know that your colleagues at the Licetti Institute just received a significant, more than $3 million grant from the Department of Defense to begin to look at potential treatments for this particular problem. So tell us a little bit about that and how that fits with the paradigm your hypothesis for
absolutely. So at the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis, I think we have a large patient population with spinal cord injury. Unfortunately, several of these patients are very young, still thinking about reproduction. Like we've done with every other specialty, we've done survivorship in just about their physical medicine, their rehab. But somehow, when we actually want them to have children, we seem to forget them. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that Dr. Imad Ibrahim, one of our faculty members here, has started the program and obtained this grant from the Department of Defense to look at sperm quality. And we're looking at specifically probenecid. It is a drug that is actually used to treat gout. But with his preliminary data working with Dr. Lin before, found out that, that drug can actually improve sperm motility in men with spinal cord injury. And so he's launched this clinical trial that just started last month to specifically look at probenecid and trying to improve sperm quality in men with spinal cord injury. Because they make sperm, but unfortunately, because of their injury and the lack of ejaculation that happens in spinal cord injury, lots of stasis of sperm happens, and the sperm that comes out is often not good quality. And so we're trying to see if we can improve the quality in these men with spinal cord injury.
And in fact, that leads to my next question. So what is the underlying problem, and how does probenecid correct that problem?
So the underlying problem is because men with spinal cord injury go for long periods of time without ejaculation. A lot of the sperm continues to get stored inside the body and therefore continues to die and remains inactive.
The senescent.
Absolutely. Okay. Whereas probenecid, which basically activates one of the factors that improves sperm motility, is now able to keep those sperm not senescent and be active when they are actually produced.
And so what options do individuals with spinal cord injury have if they want to
conceive and start a family? Yes. Yeah, so simple reproduction with assisted reproduction. We're able to use procedures such as penile vibratory stimulation, electroejaculation, and obtain a sperm sample, which we can use with something called insemination. So when the wife gets triggered around her ovulation, we're able to use a simple catheter and inside the washed semen inside the female partner and able to conceive that way.
Okay. All right. You mentioned cannabis, you mentioned marijuana and climate change and Ozempic. So are those things really able to, what do they do to impair fertility? How does Ozempic?
I think Ozempic is becoming like a routine word we see.
Yeah, everybody's in. Yeah, for weight loss.
Yes. I don't think we have enough drug for the number of people that want it. And it's advertised on every major U.S. highway here in Florida. So Ozempic is basically a GLP agonist that actually has been proven to decrease weight.
Right.
And so it's actually approved now in the U.S. both for adults as well as for adolescent obesity. Which I think is a little scary, but it is approved. And we think by losing weight, men's testosterone levels actually improve. And so if you're able to increase your own testosterone production, not from taking testosterone outside, which will actually impair fertility, if you're able to increase your own testosterone production, we talked about heat of the testis. People who are obese will have large thighs and will increase the heat around the testis and therefore affect sperm production. And if you're now able to lose weight, your testes can actually get cooler and will therefore increase its testosterone and sperm production.
So Ozempic works.
Ozempic, no. So we actually, at the University of Miami, we're now going to start a clinical trial, an open label clinical trial, single arm study to basically look at the impact of Ozempic on sperm parameters in men who are either obese or have diabetes. This has not been done as a study. This will be the first study to launch specifically to look at men who have low sperm counts and have obesity and or diabetes.
Okay, great. This is exciting. So tell us a little bit about some of the psychological effects of infertility and how are you confronting that in your practice?
Absolutely. I mean, people go through their whole lives worrying about contraception. and STIs and abstinence. And then they think having a child is a given. And when they become 25, 30, and then when they're ready to finally start a family, the last thing that they want to find out is, oh my gosh, I either don't have sperm or my sperm count is so low that I'm unable to father a child. And it affects their social stigma a lot, affects relationships a lot. I've seen couples separate and get divorced because of infertility as a reason. And I think it's an often overlooked problem. And men suffer in silence because unfortunately they can't discuss this with their female partner. Some partners are very supportive. Some don't want to bring it up because they are scared and they're in denial. And it absolutely affects their psychological problems and leads to problems like sexual dysfunction. And it gets compounded because what leads to sexual dysfunction leads to infertility, and more infertility leads to more sexual dysfunction, and it just goes as a vicious cycle.
And that's an interesting problem. You alluded to the fact that there are some cultural factors that people almost, a priori put the blame on infertility,
right,
on the woman's side.
On the female side, yeah.
And so do you think there's a psychological factor here that would prevent men from seeking,
right,
support,
from
seeking to know whether or not they are infertile?
Absolutely. I think
how do we overcome that stigma? So
a lot of efforts are actually happening in that space now, thankfully. I think men in general don't like going to doctors. They hate going to doctors. And the reason that they're
invincible.
Yeah, exactly. In denial all the time. And this goes for me too. I don't know about you, but me too. And I think it's the female partners that drive men into the doctor's offices. And I think it's very important when they actually seek care, when they finally get into the doctor's office, I think we have to address it. And I think we have to put some more onus on them to do their own work, to do their homework, and to make them feel responsible and part of this journey.
And support them.
Absolutely. And I think it's just very important that that gets addressed, because this is the first time most men are even going and seeing a doctor. They've never seen, ever since they finished their high school physicals at 18, and now they're 28, 33, and this is the first time they're seeing a doctor. And I think it's very important for us to intervene.
And you've articulated this problem so well and with such clarity. With all of the changes, I was saying, really, climate change,
right,
obesity, and any change in the temperature will affect the sperm count and the sperm motility and so forth. So it's important for people to know those things.
Absolutely.
And to actually seek their help. So I'm so glad that we have someone of your stature,
yes,
in our midst to do this work. And let's talk about yet another serious problem that men face,
right,
is erectile dysfunction.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the problem and how we begin to approach it.
Absolutely.
And as well as novel approaches.
Yeah. So about one in two men about the age of 50 suffer from erectile dysfunction, some degree of erectile dysfunction.
And then just define that for our...
Yeah, so erectile dysfunction is basically either an inability to obtain an erection or maintain an erection. And people often think it's only them that it happens to, and it doesn't happen to their friend or their gym buddy or their colleagues at work. And people need to understand that it's a very common problem. Thankfully, there's enough advertisements on Cialis and Viagra that I think people understand that there are treatments for it. But people often think that's the end, treatment, and that if the pills don't work, that they are unable to proceed beyond this. Unfortunately, lots of online pharmacies and online men's health clinics and men's health clinics that are not staffed by doctors have taken advantage of this because men don't want to go seek help. We discussed about it. And so they're very happy to go online, get some medication, and try to solve this problem on their own. And I think it's important for us, and I'm happy we're doing this, is to create awareness that there are treatments beyond just the pills that can help. And here at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, we're actually doing the first NIH-funded study looking at a trial called Cocktail. So it's a combination.
Yeah, tell us about that. You just got an NIH grant to study microvascular dysfunction.
That is exactly right.
Tell the audience about it.
Things like pills, like Cialis and Viagra, injections that can be used for erectile dysfunction, are all just Band-Aids. They don't really fix the underlying problem of erectile dysfunction. So there are now regenerative therapies that are available for research that we are doing here, called shockwave therapy and platelet-rich plasma, or PRP. So shockwave therapy.
How does that work?
Yeah, so shockwave therapy is basically high energy ultrasound. And with high energy ultrasound, simple ultrasound, high energy ultrasound, it's able to basically make new blood vessels, so neoangiogenesis. And it's able to recruit stem cells that otherwise are not present within the penis to now actually regenerate new stem, new penile tissue and smooth muscle tissue. And so in animal models, this has been done very well, and it has proven to work. But now in the humans, we're actually doing probably the only clinical trial in the United States looking at shockwave therapy. And now we're adding on PRP, or platelet-rich plasma, which is basically simply blood drawn from you, spun down, and enriched growth factors that get injected into the penis. And so we're doing a randomized placebo-controlled trial, and we're about 50% recruited into the study. And we think this would offer permanent alternatives where men don't have to be thinking about taking a pill, taking an injection every time that they're thinking about having sex. And this would address the underlying problem of blood vessels and smooth muscle issues with the penis, as opposed to just doing a Band-Aid.
We're going back to the plasma-rich factors. Now,
right.
Why would they stick around? I mean, they would have this specific lifetime,
correct.
Half-life.
That's correct. So what we do is we do the shockwave therapy first, mm-hmm. where we create a state of baseline inflammation, and then use the platelet-rich plasma injection right after that in hopes that the growth factor is now within an inflammatory state within the penis. And we also apply a tourniquet to make sure that the plasma doesn't go right back into the body, to make sure that the growth factors have enough time to stick around inside the corpus cavernosum.
So to get things going.
That's correct.
All right. Fascinating. So when can we expect some
results? So the study results are going to be due in May 2024. So about a year from now is when we will have data.
So you think that's going to be the ultimate panacea? Is that going to be the pièce de résistance?
I'm hoping. I don't know.
Holy grail for erectile dysfunction.
Yes. I mean, hopefully it is one treatment. I don't, just like anything else in medicine, I don't think it's going to be for everybody that walks in with erectile dysfunction. We think it's going to help people with mild to moderate erectile dysfunction. So guys that say, doc, I can take a Cialis and a Viagra. I'm able to get an erection, but I can't keep it long. I think those patients will help. Patients who can't even start an erection. I think this is not a good therapy.
So, and in this last segment, I really want to focus on something you talked about, which is you became a urologist
right.
because of a mentor
right.
who took interest in you. And you have modeled your life pretty much along the same principles.
Right.
You have become a very effective mentor, established summer programs. Tell us a little bit about those things that you're doing and why it's so important to you and why it's so important for us
yep.
to actually try to inspire and empower others.
Absolutely. So, I've always wanted to surround myself with peers. And that was one of my biggest reasons for why I came into academic medicine. I wanted to, when I first started here, I felt lonely. I said, there are surgical coordinators, there's physician assistants, there's nurse practitioners, there's administrative assistants all around you. But then I said, I actually want to surround myself that from people who can challenge me. And so I actually actively sought out mentees when I started, where I said, I'm happy to mentor anybody, medical students, undergraduate students, anybody. And so it really started on a quest for, let me surround myself with people who can challenge my thoughts, challenge my ideas. And I've truly had a huge passion for mentorship my whole life, because I've been fortunate to be blessed with great mentors at medical school first. Joe Barone, he's a pediatric urologist. And then at Cornell, Dr. Peter Schlegel, who sort of guided me to fertility. And then at Baylor with Dr. Lam and Dr. Lipschultz, who sort of told me what an academic career can do and how to go forward. And obviously, Dr. Parekh's help here at the University of Miami to sort of win the Gold Cystoscope Award and to guide me and navigate through obstacles. So I've been blessed with very good mentors my whole life. And I thought this is a time for me to give back. And that's what drove the passion for giving back. And I think in life we play a part in our kids' lives because we don't have a choice. They are given to us and we are given to them. We play a small part in patients' lives. And I think, they come and seek us and we try and help. And I think I love the ability to play a small part in mentees' lives and their careers and to shape their careers. And even if we have a small influence over what they do or what they achieve or what they succeed, I think it gives back us some satisfaction that we're actually doing something right. So I think that's what the motivation for doing this and hoping to continue to do this.
That's fantastic. 450 plus publication, 8 years out. How do you do it? Do you sleep? Is it this army of mentees who help with? Tell me about it. How do you do that?
No,
sister school.
So I think I do sleep. I sleep 7 to 8 hours a day. Absolutely. I think it's very important. Sleep is important for testosterone and fertility. So and erectile function. So please sleep. So I think the ability to build a team, I think was probably the most critical to this success. And to have the team sort of help you get there, I think is probably the most important thing that I've done in the last 8 years. A team of medical students, residents, fellows, and students and residents from outside the University of Miami that want to participate and want to contribute. Trusting them with responsibilities, giving them responsibilities, letting them grow in their own career journeys, and for them to give back. There's no way for me to do all of the mentoring all my own, but I think growing mentors within the team and having them guide mentees that come along, I think is probably the key to the success. There's absolutely no way I can do this on my own.
Dr. Ramasamy, what an inspiration. I'm just flabbergasted by what you've been able to accomplish.
Thank you.
In such a short time. Clearly the sky's the limit. We are blessed, we are fortunate to have someone of your caliber on the faculty of the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine in the DeSai City Urology Institute. This has been just enlightening, enriching, and truly inspiring. So thank you for spending the time telling us about male infertility, erectile dysfunction, and importantly, for serving as a role model for the next generation.
Absolutely. No, thank you very much for having me. I've been fortunate to be here, very blessed to have such a supportive environment here at the Miller School of Medicine, both with mentors, colleagues, and mentees, and really inspiring medical students, residents that come along, that come with ideas, challenge notions that exist, which hopefully help us propel and move the field forward.
And on that note, this has been yet another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine. Thank you for joining us. And thank you, Dr. Ramasamy, for inspiring us the way you have.